This is the Popular Front podcast with me, Jake Hanrahan. We're focused on the niche details of modern warfare and underreported conflict all across the world. Popular Front is completely independent. Today we're speaking to journalist Hind Hassan. She's going to be talking to us about the many, many journalists that have been killed by Israel during the current war between Israel and Gaza. Many of these journalists have actually been targeted and murdered, so assassinated. For various reasons, it doesn't seem to be something a lot of the media actually want to talk about openly. Hindo has been doing a great job bringing attention to this. She's going to tell us all about it and explain what's going on. For a lot of extra content, go to patreon.com/popularfront. I think, strangely, in some ways, one of the underreported situations happening in Gaza, considering how often it's happening, is the killing, often targeted killings by Israel of journalists out in Gaza, and also even on the borders in Lebanon. Maybe just explain to us how many have actually been killed. What's happening?
Well, there's actually different reports of how many people have been killed. So if you go to the CPJ, for example, the Committee to Protect Journalists, they say that as of today, there's 79 journalists and media workers who've been killed in total since October the 7th, but 72 of them are Palestinian who've been killed in Gaza. But Al Jazeera, for example, is reporting that over 100 journalists and media workers have been killed. And I think actually both of those figures won't reflect the reality, because there are also people who are missing. There are people who have been injured. There are people who've been threatened. That number doesn't include the number of people whose families have been killed. And the extent, the impact of the of how journalists have been impacted in Gaza goes way beyond just the figures and the numbers of those who have been killed. But just if we just consider the number of journalists who have been killed, whether you take the CPJ's figures or whether you take Al Jazeera's figures, it still stands that this is the deadliest period for journalists since records began. And that is, you know, anywhere in the world. It is a completely unique time for journalists and the threats that they are facing. And I've seen a lot of things, and you've seen a lot of things, Jake, right? We've been to a lot of conflicts, and we know that people have been killed and journalists are at risk, but this is like nothing any of us has ever seen.
So you're saying that it's more journalists have been killed since records began in a war just based on this war, Gaza?
Yeah, just in this period. And so, I mean, in this period, so since October the 7th last year, yeah. And that, to be fair, that figure, CPJ said that about the number of journalists who were killed, I think it was like a month or 5 or 6 weeks into the bombardment. So we're repeating that line now into the fourth month. But the reality is that it became the deadliest period for journalists since records began. Way back when.
That's crazy. So now it's just like way out there, just skipping ahead miles. Why is it that journalists are being targeted so much, and what evidence is there that says, yeah, they're being targeted, as opposed to they're just getting caught in what is on some level carpet bombing of Gaza?
Well, so in Gaza, I mean, I know this has been repeated over and over again, but it is worth saying over and over again, but it's a very, very small place. It is a highly densely populated small strip of land. It is, you know, the size of some of the cities in the UK. Greater Glasgow is one that I've used before to describe the square kilometre size of that strip of land. And there are 2.3 million people who live there. It is very, very difficult to find a place to go that isn't highly populated, or that there isn't civilians living there, or that you can hide from in Gaza. And so because of this bombardment that has been taking place since October the 7th by the Israeli military, it was first of all, inevitable that a lot of journalists would die, especially because they are the people who are reporting on the attacks, on the bombardments, on what is happening. So they are going to be at the front line, and there is going to be a considerable level of risk to journalists reporting on something that is happening that is so deadly. But then on top of that, there have been reports of targeted strikes. So, for example, if we just step out of Gaza a little bit, there was a number of Lebanese journalists who were killed last year who were reporting from the border of Lebanon and Israel. And one of those individuals who was killed, his name was Issam Abdullah. He was a Lebanese journalist, and the it was not the CPJ, it was the another organization. Let me just check who they were. Sorry. So Reports Without Borders did an investigation, and they didn't say that it was an Israeli airstrike. They said that it was a strike coming from the direction of Israel, but their investigation suggested that it was a targeted attack because they were clearly labeled. They were wearing press jackets. It was only journalists who were there, and it was very specifically the vehicle that was hit. And so the suggestion was that this was a targeted attack. And then after that, more journalists were killed. Other Lebanese journalists were killed at the border. And again, the same reports were coming out that it was targeted, that they were specifically being targeted because they were journalists who were reporting from the border. And then the same inside Gaza. There are journalists who are on social media every day, and they report exactly what they see and exactly what they hear. And you can almost follow their lives in real time. And some of them have reported that they've received phone calls threatening them. They have been they have been told to stop reporting. They have had anonymous phone calls from people who have said, who have asked them, why are you doing this? And don't you want to stop defending Hamas, which is not what they were doing in the first place. But there have been a lot of reports from individuals who are saying that they have definitely received threats. And there are individuals who are now so afraid that they have stopped reporting. There are a number of journalists who have left Gaza and managed to get into Egypt and escape because of the threat against them. There are people who say that they can't rent out their houses, or people won't come and let them live near them or rent their houses, because obviously so many people are displaced in Gaza. Everyone's trying to find a place to live. Some people have been displaced multiple times, but people are so wary of having journalists around them because they believe that journalists are being targeted that they won't let them stay with them or on the houses around them. There are journalists who say that some people have distanced themselves from them for fear that their families will be attacked. Just the number of people who have been killed has just been so large that everyone is now wary of being around other journalists. I mean, and just if you hear some of the stories of what's happening and how some of the journalists have been killed, there is no doubt that they have been targeted. So just for example, Hamza Dahdour, who was killed just a few days ago, was in a car with a freelance journalist. He was an Al Jazeera Arabic journalist. There was a freelance journalist with him, and the car was in an area that was believed to be a safe area. And Al Jazeera reporters say that he was at the time speaking to people who had been displaced by the bombardment, and the car was directly hit by a missile. I mean, there is no way to suggest anything other than that was a direct hit against journalists who were in that car. And there are many other stories like this. But, you know, as well as the targeting of journalists, there were, I think the CPJ said that they, Reuters, perhaps it was, had reached out to the IDF, and the Israeli military had told them that they could not guarantee the safety of their journalists inside Gaza. So there are a lot of things to consider: the targeting of journalists, and also that there has been allegations and accusations that not enough is being done to protect journalists. And sometimes, I don't know about you, Jake, but sometimes it feels really strange to be talking about journalists being killed because so many civilians have been killed and so many children have been killed. But I think it is really important to talk about this specifically because it represents an attack on, freedom of speech. And also, that's where we're getting the information from now. You and I can't go into Gaza. We can't cross in. We don't have permission from Egypt or from Israel. No international journalist has permission to go inside Gaza. There's only been one so far that has managed to go in, and they went in for 2 hours and came out, and that was it. And it was heavily controlled where they would be allowed to go.
And that was a press tour, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And so it just means that the only way we are getting information and the only way we know what is happening in terms of the reality on the ground and the impact that this is having on civilian lives is through the eyes of the journalists, the Palestinian journalists who are there, who are working day in, day out, despite the threat that is being made against their lives. And so it is really important that we lobby for them and speak for them and continue to talk about this as much as we can.
No, absolutely. I 100% agree. And something that I found quite weird I've noticed is, for example, people will say, well, those journalists in Gaza, they're in Gaza. They can't be trusted. It's propaganda. Somehow they've decided that these people are pro-Hamas, which I've not seen one of them come out and say, yeah, I'm pro-Hamas. But that's besides the point. So they'll say, oh, these guys can't be trusted and these women can't be trusted because they're Palestinian reporters in Gaza. And in the same breath, they'll take sources 100% from the fucking IDF and print that as if it's truth. Why do you think it is that suddenly everybody in the media is terrified of upsetting Israel while they have literally killed 20,000 civilians and are clearly targeting journalists? Why then are journalists suddenly a little bit more quiet than usual?
I think there's a number of reasons. A lot of journalists are currently reporting on this from inside Israel, or in order to go to Israel, they need to get permission. They need to get GPO cards, which is government press office cards. And they also will rely on them for access. So sometimes they may limit exactly what they say, because they know if they do say something that the Israeli press officers for the government or for the military are not happy with, it could impact their access. So they may limit what they're saying. And also, because journalists can't get inside Gaza, they can't report from in there. They're just receiving daily updates and press releases from the Israeli military. And so they are repeating them on air quite a lot. And I also think the Israeli government and press officers and the military are very effective at bombarding people online. Like, for example, I'll give you an example. I have tweeted about an attack that's happened inside Gaza or a journalist being killed. And on some occasions, I have been, quote, retweeted by an Israeli government press officer who will mention Hamas. My tweet was specifically about civilians being killed or hospitals not working because they have been attacked by the Israeli military. And then I will be quote retweeted with a reference to Hamas. And then underneath will be a barrage of people. What about Hamas? What about Hamas? What about Hamas? And so I think people are very hyper aware of this response and are afraid of it and perhaps might think twice about what they say as a result of that. And also in terms of speaking out for Palestinian journalists and the fact that I would have expected more people to be speaking out about what's happening to them. Honestly, is it because they're Palestinian? To be Palestinian is a political act, it seems. Just being a Palestinian immediately makes people associate you with a lot of things. And I think that this online narrative that we're hearing a lot, which is you can't say Palestinian without saying Hamas, you can't say Arab without saying terrorist, has had an impact. And so people are afraid to side with Palestinians, or not side, that's the wrong word, to speak on behalf of journalists, like their own colleagues. These are people who are in the same industry as us. An attack against them is also an attack against us. It makes the world more dangerous for us. If governments can get away with killing so many journalists like this, then what does that say for us going forward, going into other conflicts? What impact will that have in the long term? So I do think it's our duty to speak out. And I don't think we are showing enough outrage. There is a discussion in some circles that, is it the job of journalists to show outrage? I mean, a lot of the time it's not. It's our job to be there to elevate the voices of people who may not have a platform to speak.
How about the job of being a human being,
though? Exactly. This is the thing, like, we're always being told, you know, this is what a journalist should be, this is what a journalist should be. Actually, like, the work that we do, if you're out there and you're putting together a report or a documentary, and that whole documentary and report is about civilians and how they are impacted by conflict, and, you know, the vast majority of times, the people who suffer more in war, they are the most vulnerable of society. They are the children, they are the elderly, they are the poor, they are the disabled. And so it is your job to empathize with them and to be able to elevate their voices. And that is why it's great to have, so many different people from different backgrounds reporting in journalism, because you can understand certain communities or certain backgrounds more. And so therefore, perhaps you'll be able to connect with an individual and allow them to tell their story. That's it, and that is our job. And so sometimes it is our job to show sympathy or to elevate people's voices who do not have the power, or to hold governments to account. And when it comes to journalists being killed, I do think it's our job to be outraged and to speak about it, because it impacts us and it impacts the way that stories are going to be told in the future. Honestly, I'm at a loss. I sometimes feel like I'm screaming into a void. And I know it's not just me. Many, many people feel the same in this particular situation. I can't believe what we're seeing inside Gaza and what we're seeing happening to journalists, and that there isn't some sort of cross-media collaboration to condemn it or to come out and try and create some level of protection for journalists. And I've spoken to a lot of people who work in different news organizations and different, media organizations. And there are a lot of people who feel like this, but we're not seeing enough being done. And it's continuing. It's not slowing down. It's not stopping. It's continuing.
No, totally. I think you've touched on something really important there. And it's something I've always got flack from since starting Popular Front, which I completely think is nonsense. The way that people say, oh, well, you put feeling into this, you put feeling into that, we shouldn't be outraged. Being outraged is not part of our job as a journalist. What the fuck is that? Like, that is crazy. You're telling me that somehow a journalist would be better at their job if they weren't annoyed, outraged, and worried that their fellow colleagues are being targeted and murdered alongside tens of thousands of civilians. If that doesn't bother you and doesn't make you outraged, you should not be in the field as a reporter, because to not be outraged by that means you cannot understand life as a fucking human being and you can't put real situations into context. So I would argue, if you're not outraged about that, you're actually a terrible reporter and shouldn't be anywhere near anything. I mean, Jesus Christ. I mean, journalists shouldn't be Siri. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's not how it is. It's about contextualizing human life and human death. And I really think that's such an absurd thing to say. And the unfortunate thing is as well, like you were saying as well, they're like, oh yeah, well, Gazans immediately get associated with Hamas. Several weeks before even October 7th, there was a survey done on Gazans, and 67% of the people in Gaza expressed that they did not like Hamas and that they had problems with Hamas. And if anybody knows any Palestinian actually from Gaza, they will know that Hamas ran that place horribly with an iron fist, and a lot of people were under a lot of problems. The idea that all of those people suddenly changed in one day is absolute nonsense. And I really think it's disgusting that all of these people that are dead now are suddenly like, oh, they're terrorists now. Do you think that, okay, that's like a ridiculous thing we see on the internet, but do you think that's also something that maybe, I don't know, it feels like editors maybe even fucking think that from some of the reports I'm seeing? Because let's be honest, nobody is actually objective. Everybody has an opinion, especially on this.
I think making a decision on how you portray individuals because you are assuming their who they support politically is just bizarre as it stands. They are civilians. That's who they are. They are civilians. Like, the Hamas election happened so many years ago, and it happened with the full support of the international community, the United States included. It had international observers who watched the elections and said it was a fair election. But at the time, not everyone, first of all, 50% of Palestinians, or 2.3 million people who live in Gaza, are under the age of 18. So immediately there were a whole bunch of people who never voted in that election. All those years ago, the elections were like 17 years ago, right? Half the population never voted in it. And then not all of the population voted at the time. And then not all of the people who did vote voted for Hamas. A lot of them voted for Fatah and other people. And so actually, if you did the maths and worked out how many people, the current population, voted for Hamas, it was a minority of people there. Forget that, though. That was so long ago that right now they are civilians who live in Gaza. They cannot leave without the permission of Israel. They have high unemployment rates, high malnutrition. They struggle in so many areas of their lives. They are civilians. That is the only context with which they should be treated with. Civilians. How many civilians are being killed? You can't say, oh, well, it's okay that they were killed because we think or assume that maybe they had some feelings towards Hamas. Just like you wouldn't say that about, you know, any other civilian in any other part of the world. And I do think a lot of these arguments that are being made in bad faith. They're being made in order to project a certain idea about people. And the same thing with the journalists and the arguments about, you know, journalists can't show outrage or journalists shouldn't be, you know, showing emotions. That only happens in certain conflicts and in certain wars, and is only said by certain, you know, corners. When we report from Ukraine, some of our colleagues have been killed there, and it's horrific. And we are allowed to be able to mourn them. And we should be allowed to be able to mourn them. And I didn't see that really being questioned unless it comes from a certain corner of the political spectrum that perhaps oppose Ukraine politically. And so I think we just need to strip away the politics and just stick with humanity, because that's the only way that you know that you're morally on the right side. And if your colleagues who are doing a job are being killed in incredible numbers, and there is no protection, and you are in a privileged position outside in the world, then it is your job to say, look what's happening to our profession. And there's no other profession in the world that would be told you can't speak out. There are unions, there are movements. Every single profession and industry in the world, people speak out to protect the individuals who work alongside them. That is exactly what we're supposed to do. And I think just the stories of what's happening inside, maybe people aren't hearing what's happening. Maybe people aren't hearing the stories. It's beyond belief. You couldn't write this in a film. So just to tell the story of Wael al-Dahdour, he's a Al Jazeera Arabic journalist. He's the bureau chief of Gaza. He didn't just start working since October the 7th. He has been working for Al Jazeera Arabic for years. People are used to seeing him. If you watch Al Jazeera Arabic, you'll be used to seeing him on your screens. So, but the trauma that he has experienced is absolutely incredible. And yet he keeps on going. So his story is that on the 25th of October, he was working for Al Jazeera Arabic and he was reporting on an Israeli airstrike on a refugee camp in Gaza. And it was the same refugee camp that his family were seeking refuge in. So they were living in that refugee camp. He then finds out that most of his family were killed in the attack, in that strike. So his wife, his 15-year-old son, his 7-year-old daughter, his grandson. Al Jazeera Arabic then basically, they film him entering the hospital. I think it was at Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. And they film him when he goes in and sees his dead family. They show him like you can see the footage on the internet. It's really horrific. They show him like crouching, touching the face of his son. And it's just so devastating. And for most people, that would be enough. It's really horrific. For most people, that'd be enough to lose it, right? This guy, he carries on working. He doesn't take a break. And we see him back on Al Jazeera Arabic almost immediately. In fact, I remember I was watching their channel and I saw him reporting live on an airstrike. There'd been an airstrike in a residential area. And there he was reporting live, talking to the camera. And as he's moving around the destruction, showing the damage of what happened, there was a man with a child's body passing by him, shouting and crying. There were people like digging, trying to get into the rubble to dig people out, moving the concrete with their bare hands because there's no emergency workers there to do that. And there were people screaming for help to get people out from under the rubble. So this man who'd almost lost his entire family continued to report and was showing the horrors of what was happening around him. And then on the 15th of December, he was with a colleague of his, a cameraman called Samra Abu Dhaka, and they were reporting for Al Jazeera Arabic. They were at a UN school in Gaza when it was hit. There was an attack and both of them got injured. Samra couldn't move because I think it was his leg that was injured, but Wael could. And he managed to escape and try and get help for his colleague. So his colleague was then stuck in this UN school and there were medics and ambulances trying to get to him. But the Israeli military kept firing at the medics, so they couldn't get in. So the medics and I think Al Jazeera, people behind the scene, were all in communication with the Israeli military, begging for them to allow this ambulance to get in so they could get to this man that was bleeding out. And I was watching this in real time. This was being reported on Al Jazeera Arabic. It was on Twitter. It was on the internet. And I couldn't believe it. I felt like I was living in this alternate reality because in real time, people were saying, he's bleeding. He's bleeding out. Medics can't get to him. We need ambulances to get to him. Then the ambulances managed to get to him over 5 hours. I think maybe 6 hours had passed by. The medics finally got to him. By the time they got there, Samra Abu Dhaka was dead. So he's just seen most of his family being killed. He's in an attack and now his colleague has bled out and was killed. And then on this Sunday just gone, so the 7th of January, 2024, his 27-year-old son, Hamza Ad-Dahdour, who's also a journalist, also works for Al Jazeera Arabic, was in Khan Yunis, which is in the south of Gaza, in an area that was supposed to be safe. He was in a car and he was with a freelance journalist called Mustafa Thureya. And they were in a supposedly safe area. And I think I mentioned this at the beginning of our chat, but he was, according to Al Jazeera journalists, he was reporting on displaced civilians and people who had to leave their homes. And then their car was hit by an Israeli strike. And there's footage of this online. You can see it. The car is completely annihilated. There's absolutely no chance for survival. So now his eldest son, his 27-year-old son, has been killed. And again, we see Al Jazeera Arabic filming everything. And they film Wael standing over the body of his dead son in hospital, crying, holding his hand. And at this point, the camera pans and shows everyone in the room and everyone is crying. The people holding the camera is crying. Like, I'm nearly crying now. I dare you to watch that and not cry with them and not feel something. And then at the burial, you see they filmed the burial, and Hamza is stood there. Sorry, not Hamza, Wael is stood there, and he's wearing his press jacket. And everything you see, he's wearing his blue press jacket, and he's struggling to stay composed. But he pays tribute to his son and says that his son was like a righteous man, a patient, generous man. He asks for God's mercy and basically says, "We will continue. We will continue doing what we're doing." And he returned, continued reporting pretty soon after his son was killed. There's this footage that you can also find somewhere online where he's doing a live, and there's just people gathered around him filming him, because he's like this titan of a journalist, you know. And it's do people know this? Do people know about these stories? Do people know this is what's happening? Could you imagine any scenario where that is happening and there it's not on the front page of every newspaper? I know that this is it has, to be fair, there are news organizations have been reporting on his death, but I don't think it's enough. The tale is just beyond comprehension. It's catastrophic.
The irony is that this guy is acting so stoically that in some ways he's presenting himself exactly as the people who argue that journalists shouldn't be outraged or have feelings are presenting themselves. Not that obviously he has feelings, he's absolutely distraught. What I mean is his professional stoicism is so good that he's managing to go back to doing his job after his whole fucking family has been killed, and then he doesn't get the coverage. So these people want you to have no feelings and no emotions, and then when a man whose whole family is killed, murdered, and he carries on reporting stoically, suddenly it doesn't apply.
That's a really good point. I'd never thought of it like that. That's honestly a
right. That should be the perfect example of what they want, no? I mean, this is the way you are like this is what normal everyday people feel. I was watching the news with my grandma, and she is not political. She's checked out. She does her thing. She's great. She's smart, but you know, she's old and she's just chilling. And even she's watching it and she's like, look at all these children dead in Gaza. Like, this is just heartbreaking. That's what normal people tend to think. And this is why people don't trust journalists, because some weirdo Primrose Hill fucking commissioning editor tells you that you shouldn't have feelings, actually. No, people do not want robots. When something catastrophic happens, it's catastrophic no matter where it is. Now, all freedom to Ukraine. I fully support Ukraine's fight against Russia. And I hate to even bring it into this, but a point I want to make here is Zelensky, you know, he's a pretty brave guy, acts brave. He does cool shit. He's got some good catchphrases. He turns up everywhere in OD green and a jumper. And I guarantee you right now they're making a film about him. Sean Penn was, you know, up his ass. Where's that same energy for this guy whose whole family is dead and he's still reporting? But there's very clearly the correct opinion and they're not allowed the correct opinion. And that shouldn't be a part of reporting. But in my opinion, there has never been something so polarized and obvious that it actually is as this current onslaught on Gaza. And people say to us, oh, you're being pro-Palestine. I'm like, bro, I'm just pro not massacring civilians. It's that simple. And apparently that's hard to understand.
Interestingly enough, some of the people who have messaged me and spoken about what's happening to it, what's happening in Gaza and the journalists there, have been Ukrainian friends of ours that we've made whilst working in Ukraine, journalists that we've worked with, journalists who live in Kharkiv and who have seen the worst of war, who've seen civilians and innocents being killed, who know the sacrifices that journalists make to work in the front line and to potentially, you know, to be killed at any moment. They have stayed in contact and reached out and, you know, are constantly in disbelief at what's happening, because again, I totally agree with you, what you said about, you know, sitting and watching with your grandmother, because the reality is that it's normal to react in a certain way, especially if you have experience in that field or in conflict, to to just feel along with civilians or people who are just doing their job. And sometimes when you work in journalism, I think you are surrounded by a lot of people, other journalists perhaps, who you're all doing a job and it's all what documentary we're going to do, who we're going to interview, what's the report that we're going to do. And there is, to some extent, a level of you have to kind of disconnect in your mind the reality of what's happening in order to be able to report on so much horror. And so you maybe need to continuously, you know, get your speak to people who are, who think in a different way, who are just civilians, who are normal. I'm trying to be careful about what I say, but I'm just going to say it. I've said this a million times, but me and you know, we know, like, the media and is probably one of the most elitist industries. And actually, it's not probably.
Definitely the most.
We've seen that. Statistics have shown that over and over and over again, that in journalism, you get a lot of people who come from private school backgrounds. And there are, it's an expensive industry to get into. You've got to pay for a master's, which costs thousands of pounds. You've got to have connections to be able to get in at certain, in certain companies where it's a very tight-knit community. Or you have to live in London, which is super expensive. And if you don't have the money to do that, or if you don't have a place to live, then, you know, how will you be able to work for free for companies at the beginning? And so it ends up that a lot of people in journalism, there is a higher representation of people from a certain background. And I think the reality is, if you leave your office and if you leave the environment and the place that you work with, and you go to, I'm from Hull, if you go to Hull, or if you go to Kettering, or if you go to wherever, people are different to what they are in the newsroom. And the reality is that most of the people where that you go to back home or that you speak to, what they will see is innocent people being killed, or people that shouldn't be killed being killed. And they will relate to somebody on talking, or a journalist who is empathizing with that. And I think we've got to a certain place in journalism. Also, we have to understand that there's lots of different types of journalism. There's people who do live breaking news. And when you do live breaking news, you're just maybe relaying the facts of what's happening. And sometimes that's difficult because it doesn't provide a lot of time for context. And it's, this has happened, this has happened, this has happened. But if you are doing, if you are putting together news reports, or if you are putting together documentaries, the whole point of a documentary is to give people a platform to be able to tell the world what they're experiencing. How can you do that if you don't connect with the individuals that you're speaking to? You don't walk into a house wearing a suit and a tie and be like, hello, person whose language I don't speak, please tell me exactly what you feel. Like, they're going to tell you to fuck off and get out their house.
Ironically, though, that is quite a lot of what the news is. Like, it's that, it's presented like that. And that's why your average person doesn't watch it. I think journalists forget that, like, less than 1% of the people in the newsroom are who watch it. Your audience, like, people treat their audience with such disdain, or they don't even think about them. And it's like, are you making this for other journalists, or are you making it for everyone? And I think the vast majority of journalism I see coming out of London newsrooms is making it for other journalists. Like, oh, hopefully we win this award, or hopefully we do. Your average person doesn't give a fuck, and nor should you. And that's the point. You have to be focused on the people and what you're doing. Now, I'm not saying, oh, I'm so great, you're so great. But, like, it's a genuine problem, like you've said. That said, if you go back to, I know you've done a lot of reporting in Palestine and Israel. If you go back, what would you focus on?
I mean, there's just a million things to focus on. In the West Bank, you have a whole separate thing going on. You've got an increase in attacks. Yeah, an increase in attack from settlers. Jenin is being raided constantly. There has been, and even before October the 7th, it was coming on to last, 2023 was becoming the deadliest year for the West Bank in terms of Palestinians being killed by the military or in settler attacks for the past 20 years. And then after October the 7th, obviously that number shot up. And what we're seeing in the West Bank is very, very concerning. There was already an increase in the number of settlements, illegal settlements that were being set up. You know, we've almost forgotten about the Israel's far-right government that came to power and the impact that that was having on Palestinians who were living in the West Bank and the increase in raids and the number of children who are being killed there. I also think that the number of attacks that have been taking place against health care hospitals and healthcare facilities has been significant. MSF has released multiple press releases where they have stated that they have witnessed people being shot around health facilities or raids taking place or medics being stopped and having to get out the car and get down on the floor or being searched. And I think there's a lot to research and there's a lot to report on. And I think if I was to go to Palestine and Israel right now, I think the focus would definitely be the West Bank.
Mm-hmm. You've taken a lot of this kind of on your back in a way, putting out info detailing how many Palestinian reporters have been targeted and killed, or at least that's the way I see it. I mean, obviously we're friends, so I look out and see what you're doing, but it does seem to me like a majority of things I see shared, it's you doing it. Do you feel that you've kind of painted a bit of a target on your back? Now, God forbid, I don't mean literally physically, but it's certainly frowned upon, obviously, it's frowned upon to point out how many Palestinian reporters have been killed. Do you feel like that's something that might negatively affect you with your career?
I can't lie and say that I'm not concerned. You know, there is always a risk in Israel and in Palestine and going and reporting from there. It is, at the moment, an active conflict zone. There's a lot of military. There are people being killed, shot. There are journalists who say they've been harassed and who've been targeted. And we know, we've seen people have been killed. And I've been in situations before where I have been fired at. I've been in a group of journalists and we've been fired at with sponge tip bullets by Israeli riot police. And the situation now is a lot more intense than it was previously. And so, yes, there is a consideration that goes into your mind that traveling there is dangerous and you've got to be careful. But the reality is I stick to the facts. I stick to figures. Everything that I write is sourced. Everything that I'm writing is facts and figures and sources, and this is the reality on the ground. And I am not unique. There are many, many other journalists who are experiencing the exact same thing, who are reporting, who are facing risks, and who are continuing to do that. So if I'm going to do this job, and if I'm going to be a journalist who reports from the region, then it is a duty of mine to continue to report on the facts. Doesn't mean that I don't think that I'll face risks or that it's not a little bit scary. I'm not, you know, I'm happy to admit that, but I think there's no other way to do this. And I think just continuously watching the journalists and following the people that I've been following inside Gaza every single day just shows, actually, I'm doing this. A lot of the reporting I'm doing is from the comfort of my home. And so therefore, it's actually the least that I can do at the moment.
Yeah, no, I mean, we're doing this thing that journalists do where they blow smoke up each other's asses. But last thing I'll say is, that's what I say. So a lot of kind of be activists within the Palestinian scene, I'll see them share stuff and it's like, nah, that's just not right. It's just not right. It's not based on fact. It's based on feelings and it's just not real. What I do say is go and check out what Hind is saying, because 100% I agree with you. I've even looked up some of this shit like, really? Because everything you're saying is sourced and okay, people might tell you you're this, you're biased, you're this, like they do with me all the time. But at the end of the day, if your sources are right and your numbers are right, they can be angry, but they're not right. You're right. You see what I'm saying? So I totally agree with that. And I definitely think people should follow your lead and look at what you're doing. But again, we're doing the whole like, oh, journalists are so special. We're not that special. But when people are being targeted like this, like they are in Palestine, these are the people that will facilitate the news out from there. This is such a specific situation where other people can't get in. If they do get in, it's for like 20 minutes and it's an IDF press tour. So this is why it's something so important. And with that, is there anyone you would suggest, like reporters on the ground in Gaza now that people should go and look up?
Yeah, there's so many. Mu'taz, Bissan, Wa'il, Al Dahdour. Watch Al Jazeera Arabic. Put Al Jazeera Arabic on and you'll see a whole different world. You know, you can put on one of the other news organizations and you'll see glimpses of what's happening. And that's not to say, by the way, like I've seen some really brilliant reports that have come out of, you know, that Channel 4 have done on Gaza, or that, you know, CNN have done on Gaza, individual reports that have been put together by journalists who are inside Gaza on the ground. And sorry, earlier when I was saying that there was one journalist that did manage to get into Gaza, that was CNN reporter Clarissa Ward, who went in.
She's great, yeah.
With, I think it was with the medics who were going to a field hospital, and they went just for a couple of hours. So they're the only journalist, one journalist, who went in for a few hours from the Rafah border, Egypt, into Gaza, and then they had to leave very quickly. But even then, that didn't, it was actually very powerful, but they didn't get access to all the things that all the other journalists got access to. And so, yeah, watch Al Jazeera Arabic, watch Wa'il, watch Bissan, watch Mu'taz, watch the million. Actually, there's like, if you go on some of my posts, there's like a whole bunch of people who have listed their names. And if you go on to, for example, Mu'taz has got like 17 million followers now. The guy's like so young, but he's become the face of Gaza, along with some of his other friends and colleagues. And they're all, by the way, they all know each other. So for example, Hamza Dahdour, who was killed on Sunday, they were all friends with him. And my whole timeline became old pictures of him with all these other journalists, because it's such a small place. There's no way that you don't know everybody in the industry. And so every single person that is killed is another personal bereavement and grief that they have to go through and then continue doing their jobs. But there are literally dozens of people that you can find very, very easily. Just go on one person's site and you'll see a whole list of others. And there are other people. For example, there was a guy who, I think it Mu'min al-Sharif, who also works for Al Jazeera. But some of these people are not on social media as well, by the way. There's a lot of people on socials, and there's some people who are just reporting on air or behind the scenes. But for example, Mu'min, 21 members of his family were killed after the refugee camp that they were staying in was bombed. He lost his parents, his sister, two brothers, sister-in-law, their children, lots of other people. And he basically went live on Al Jazeera Arabic soon after they were killed. And he did this really, really, really long interview. And he spoke about how rescue workers hadn't reached the bodies of his family members and they couldn't get to them. And he also spoke about the fact that he hasn't been able to see his mother since the start of the war, because he's been trying to work and he's been working and they have been seeking refuge and displaced. And on air, they played the voicemail that she had sent to him a few days back, asking God to keep him safe and, you know, praying for when the war will end. And so there are also, you know, there's a lot of footage that you can watch, which really explains not just the reality on the ground, not just like, oh, this school has been bombed and this place has been bombed and, you know, these amount of people have been killed, because you're hearing that over and over again. And now that you're hearing 22,000 people killed, it doesn't become like a real thing that you can actually grasp and comprehend. So if you go and you listen to, you know, Mu'min talking about his family, I hope I've got his name right, talking about his family and the impact that it's had on him, and hearing his mother's voice, then you really relate, or you can feel something. And I think that's the most important thing, is when you're seeing so much horror, you can become immune to it, and people just get used to it. And you need to keep reminding yourself that they have families and lives just like you do, that every single person killed is a name, that every single person of those 22,000 people who have been killed was someone who had dreams, who had, you know, ideas about what they wanted to do in their life, who had passions, who were hoping they could wake up the next day and do something that they've always wanted to do. And that doesn't exist anymore. So as well as following, I think it's really good to follow the people on the ground on socials, because they're also doing these live updates every day about how they're feeling and what's happening. And they're showing little moments with kittens on the street or a little kid who's like making them tea. And it really, really humanizes you. And I think what we've seen in this conflict is a lot of times the way that it's being reported, there's been a lot of dehumanization of civilians and Palestinians. And this way you can really, really humanize people, because remember, 22,000 people, 22,000, I think the last figure was nearly 23,000. And Gaza's population is 2.3 million. Do the maths. That's one in every 100 person has been killed in Gaza.
Crazy. It's absolutely crazy. It's diabolical. I think the best thing to do would be to like link your social media, because there's so many people, and I know you're constantly like sharing stuff from all these Palestinians on the ground. So where should people follow you in to get the information and see the links to all these others?
I'm on Instagram, and it's a strange one. I should have just called it my name. Why is it that instead of just calling things your name, you end up doing like weird, like my Gmail account is so ridiculous. My Instagram is Hanoud. Let me just spell it for you. It's H. Yeah, it is Hanood 7SN. Weird, I know. It's Hanoud. That's like my nickname in Arabic. Hanoud, and then the seven is a heart. This is too much information. The seven is a heart in Arabic, so it's Hanoud Hassan, but it just writes as Hanoud 7SN. I know, that was far too much. You're like, shut up and carry on.
Anyway, the Twitter, come on.
Hind Hassan News.
All right, excellent. Thank you very much, Hind. That was really, really important, I think.
Thanks for having me on, Jake. You're a superstar.
No, of course. Finally, you can come on. But I didn't want to do this thing where it's like, oh, journalists talking about journalists. But in this situation, it's very, very different. So I hope people understand that. Thank you so much.
Totally agree. Thank you for having me on.
That was the Popular Front podcast. If you want more exclusive bonus episodes, extra video content, access to the Popular Front network, ad-free episodes, and other Patreon-only shows that we do, subscribe to patreon.com/popularfront. We are entirely grassroots and independent. Nobody owns us. Patreon keeps us going, as does our merchandise. You can get Popular Front apparel and accessories at www.popularfront.shop. You can also buy our various publications there, like the Popular Front magazine, which comes out 4 times a year. We are censored on social media and streaming platforms, so please follow and share our content. Watch our documentaries at youtube.com/popularfront. Follow us on Instagram at popular.front, Twitter at popularfront_, and for uncensored updates on the world at war, follow our Telegram at popularxfront. If you want to keep track of my other projects, it's the same on all socials at Jake_Hanrahan. That's HANRAHAN. For all these links and more, go to www.popularfront.cc. The music in this episode was produced by Sam Black. Check him out at samblackpf.com or search Sam Black PF on Spotify. The intro music is by Home. If you want to advertise with us and you're not literally evil, email jake@hanrahan.tv. Thank you to the Patreons on the credit tier. They are Onofrio Modogno, Pengu, Jessica, Peter Cherry, Lupe Calderon Garnica, Thomas Giuseppe, Viola Forvel, Christian Bustamante, Daniel Verdin, Margosha, Rohan, Ryan Barbadillo, VS, Brian R, Evan Pank, Bradley Hope, Wizard Actual, Benjamin Topper, Siddhartha O, Damien, Cameron Collins, Scott Turnbull, Matthew Diffley, Claire, Liana, Robert, Sean, Cusinart 8, Chris Janovich, NTHG, Ethan Zwick, Peter Nybratton, Gabrielle K, David McManus, Tom Petrie, James Leons, Bradley Davies, No Dogs, No Hamsters, Brendan Crave, B, Dallas Dunn, LD50 Seattle, Adam H, B, Rambo, Larson8669, Ivan Julien, Diamondstein, Michael O'Connor, Nicholas Butter, JD, James Karpinski, Jav, James Colley, Ethan Fitzmadrid, Ed Coulthard, D. San, Mike Barone, Scott Hopton, Liam Williams, Propaganda, DZA, Giorgio Arani, Vegan Straight Edge, Amy, Rubicon, Frank Austin, Caitlin Wicks, Michael Neck, Freya Northman, Andrew Hurley, Vida Provost, Brian McLaughlin, Tom Lochrin, Young Wasabi, Tony Bin, Adam Bergsnyder, JL, Stephen Davila, Chad Walker, Peter McCormick from What Bitcoin Did, Christopher Martin, Ryan Sandercock, and Maurice Zumbul. Thank you all so much. Support us at patreon.com/popularfront.